This is Carl Munson of Tradio.com talking to Sean Chamberlain, who's got a book called The Transition Timeline, just about to come out, I think, isn't it, Sean? Do you want to say a little bit about the book?
Yeah, sure. I mean, the book grew out of requests from transition initiatives who were looking at their Energy Descent Action Plan process, so trying to look at the future of their community over the next 20 years. And they found that there were things which were sort of outside their scope to look at, sort of big issues like food supply to the UK, for example, or peak oil and climate change, that they really needed someone to provide them with some research to give them a context within which their local communities were developing. And so the timeline tries to do that, to scope out these things which are going to affect them, but which maybe they can't affect. Also, it looks at the latest evidence on peak oil and climate change, and importantly on the interactions between the two, because there are a lot of misconceptions about how the two affect each other. And probably the part that's going to be most sort of recognisable about the book is that it lays out four scenarios for how the next 20 years could pan out in the UK. Should I mention what those
yeah,
four are?
Yeah, please do, that would be great.
So there's the denial scenario, which is essentially a continuation of business as usual and not acknowledging the sort of environmental crises that we're facing and reaping the consequences of that. And in that scenario, for example, I think by 2016, in that scenario, we hit unstoppable runaway climate change, for example. And then the next scenario we look at is called hitting the wall. And in that scenario, we acknowledge that these problems exist, but we try to deal with them through existing ways of thinking, through sort of free market mechanisms and through the same kind of thinking that got us into the problem in the first place and really fail to address them satisfactorily. The third is what we call the impossible dream, which is the sort of the scenario that many people have in their minds where renewable technology sort of rides into the rescue and everything's fine and we just transition happily from oil to solar panels and wind power and it's a very smooth process. But when you actually look at the facts and figures on that, it's not really possible that it can work out that way. So in this scenario, which I've called the impossible dream, we follow that story that that's what's going to happen, but we end up facing a lot of difficulties because we can't really bring the energy supply online that we need in time. Mm. But the real focus of the book is on the fourth scenario, which is the transition vision, which is our sort of best realistic case scenario as to how the future could pan out. And that's looked at in a lot more depth than the other three scenarios. We look at trends on population and demographics, we look at healthcare, we look at food and water, travel and transport, energy. So all these sections are looked at in detail, and we look at the current position and the current trends, and then at the kind of new ways of thinking that we need to avoid the unpleasant consequences of those trends. So the kinds of cultural stories that we need to shift in order to thrive and move into a thriving, resilient future, given the energy constraints that we face and the carbon, the climate constraints that we face. And so we look at the present position and trends and the cultural story change, and then we lay out our transition vision in detail of how each of these areas, food and transport and energy, could map out over the next 20 years in a really positive, happy, thriving way.
Brilliant. And if people want to find out more about the book, where should they go?
Well, the book's being published by Green Books, so there'll be details on their website. Also, my personal website, darkoptimism.org, has details on the book, so those would be the two places to look.
Okay, brilliant. I wanted to ask you, I've quit my job to save the planet, is how I put it.
Yeah,
in good company. And the conversations I tend to have with people, I think there are three basic groups of people, and I wondered if you had a message for each of them. But first, I guess I've got to tell you what the groups are.
Yeah.
And the first group, I think, are the people who are in denial, which is the first of your four scenarios,
okay.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
What message, what brief message, if you were stuck in a lift, or not stuck in a lift, if you were going from floor one to floor 10 with a lift full of people in denial about what you feel is ahead of us, what would you say to them
in that short
space of time?
I mean, I actually find that the state of denial that these kind of people are in is quite an interesting one, because I rarely meet anyone who says to me, if I say, you know, do you think that our current way of life is sustainable? Nobody ever says yes. They'll say, oh, no, there's all this terrible, you know, fisheries are collapsing, global warming. Everyone thinks it's unsustainable. Nobody seems to make the connection between it being unsustainable and the fact that it's going to end, which is what unsustainable means.
Right, yeah.
And so...
Always it's like an abstract thing.
Yeah,
it's
in the abstract.
But
it's unsustainable. But, you know, sustainability, greenies care about that. That's nothing to do with
me.
But the connection between that and the fact that it's going to end seems to be lacking. And so I actually almost never meet anyone who says, actually, everything's fine. I suppose you get people who think whatever the problems are, technology will solve them.
Yeah.
That's kind of one kind of denial that I encounter a lot.
So how do you tend to undermine denial when you do come across it? I guess you've written a book. That's a good start, isn't it?
That's one part of it, certainly. I suppose generally asking questions works quite well, rather than trying to, you know, sit someone down and say, oh, I think this and I think that, and if you check the evidence, I think you'll find.
Yeah, no one likes to be told they're wrong,
do
they?
No, so I tend to try and follow through what they're thinking. I mean, if someone did come to me and say, oh, well, actually, you know, I'm sure we can, you know, carry on with all the things we're currently doing and everything will just work out fine.
Yeah.
You know, and you sort of ask, well, how could it be that, you know, for example, we've got these finite resources, these finite fossil fuels, and they're the primary energy source for our society. They're going to run out. Everyone knows they're finite resources. So, okay, that's interesting that you think that's totally so. So explain to me how that's going to work, you know? And then maybe they say, oh, well, you know, we'll use them to have huge amounts of renewable energy, and so we'll transition happily from this to the sort of renewable hydrogen economy or whatever. You say, okay, well, I mean, hydrogen's an interesting one because, you know, it's not actually an energy source. It's like a battery. You know, you can't say, oh, well, after electricity, we'll move to the battery economy.
Yes.
And so you say, okay, so how are we going to power ourselves on hydrogen if we don't have the energy with which to? And they say, oh, and you know, just sort of asking questions and getting them to think it through rather than kind of trying to thrust things down their throat, I suppose.
So as ever, the conversation is all important, isn't it, to be in the conversation?
Yeah, absolutely.
Which I guess would bring us
because I think, you know, I don't know what your other two groups of people are, as you're probably about to tell me, but
I was about to neatly segue into the next group.
But they all probably exist within all of us.
Absolutely,
I mean, I think we have a part of us that just... I mean, I find... I remember a couple of years ago, I was sort of doing an awful lot of research sort of on my own in my room very miserably on climate change and Big Oil and wondering what to do maybe a few years ago. And I was learning about all this, and I'd learned about the biofuels situation and how 30% of the US corn crop was being turned into biofuels, wheat crop, and how that was pushing up prices and how it was causing all these problems. And I was, you know, writing articles about this and everything. And it all existed inside my computer somehow. It wasn't in my world. And then I went round the corner to buy a loaf of bread at our local bakery. And there was a sign in the window saying that they'd almost been forced out of business because the price of flour had doubled because of this very problem, and saying it's because of the biofuels and everything and that they've had to put their prices up and they're very sorry. And it was strange because I'm someone who was spending my whole time working on this, knew all about it. And yet on a sort of visceral, immediate level, the fact that it was there at my local bakery just somehow made it more real, even to me. So I think the denial's in all of us somehow.
Well, that's yes. And that brings us on to my next group, who I come across, and this is the doomers or the despair group.
Uh-huh.
So from denial into despair. I guess after denial, when you've genned up on the facts and you've seen that your local bakery's gone out of business because of flour, and you've read about it, flour prices, and you've been genning yourself up on the web, there is that awful time, isn't there, of despair.
Absolutely.
The Derek Jensen. Place.
Yeah.
If you like. What do you say to people in that? And there are a lot of people, and I've been in that pain, and I'm not trying to make light of it now because it is a very serious and difficult place to be.
Yeah, I mean, I defend Derek Jensen a little from that accusation. I wouldn't particularly put him as a doomer. I just think he has a very different idea of what's desirable than most people.
I mean, no disrespect to him.
But certainly, I mean, you know, I had an awful lot of interactions with people. In fact, to be honest, my first introduction to Peak Oil was, I think, in 2000. I received an email from my father, completely out of the blue. I mean, not to get an email from my father, but the subject was. And he basically said, there's been this study, and it's showed that, you know, we're approaching the peak of oil and slightly later gas, and outlining a very, very doomerish, but nonetheless still quite plausible timeline of how things could map out. And in fact, it's not that dissimilar from the denial timeline in my book.
Mm.
Back then, because I sort of thought, oh, come on, it can't be that serious. I mean, surely people would be talking about it if there was something that big going on. And I thought, well, you know, I'll look into it a bit. And he was feeling very, very, you know, doomerish, as you say, very, very concerned and troubled by it. And so I decided to sort of look into it in order to set his mind at rest, really.
And yes, it makes a change from, are you coming home for Christmas?
It does. It's quite difficult of my father, though.
But it's a bit like, you know, I thought you ought to know, you know, about this peak oil thing. Well, that's good fatherly advice, isn't it?
He's an unusual man, is my father. Right. A wonderful one. But back then there was really one website that existed on this stuff, which was jhansonsdieoff.org, which is a cheerily named site in its own right. It's still a fantastic source of information. But you know, I was looking at the stuff on there, and I was, as you say, coming through that period that I think we all go through, the peak oil moment, as Rob puts it, where you sort of think, you know, God, what's happening here? This is terrifying.
Well, and everything you touch is oil related,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah.
In your
everywhere
daily life.
Everywhere you look, and you start thinking, oh well, I'll just relax by, oh no, that as well.
Yes,
you know?
Yeah.
And there is that, but I think, I mean, that's almost where I came in, is I sort of thought, well, however bad the situation might be, there are always better and worse choices to make. I mean, even if we were on the Titanic and we'd hit the iceberg and we're sinking, you know, there are still better and worse things you can do. You can help people into lifeboats, or you can pray, or, you know, whatever it is that might be. There are always better and worse. So my first thought was, okay, if it really is that bad, we still need to decide what we're going to do. And, you know, we still need to deal with it in the best way we can. And my second thought was, well, is it really that bad? And I think one of the key things about transition that I find really, really exciting is that it's the sort of realization that the same kinds of things which have led us to these sort of point of environmental crisis in many ways are the same kind of things that have actually made us less happy. That, you know, the kind of things that we need to do to solve these problems, like reducing our demand for energy and for consumable goods, and the same kind of things that have led us to this place that we're in now, have also led us away from things like community and like a sense of well-being. And, you know, we have this, I mean, I talk a lot about cultural stories. That's sort of one of my key concepts. And what I mean by that is the underlying assumptions that we have in our culture and as individuals about what life's about and where we're going. For example, we have this story that what we're living in now is the most advanced civilization there's ever been. And, and that's really deeply held. You know, the whole of human, well, the whole of evolution and everything has led to this wonderful, amazing situation that we're in now. And, you know, if you try and evidence that belief, it's very, very hard, because, you know, in a couple of hundred years of using fossil fuels, it looks like we might have destroyed the sustainability of our environment, and, you know, depression rates are at all-time highs and suicide rates. It's really hard to find a way of justifying that.
When you put it like that.
And yet, if you do try and challenge that position, that sense that we're in this incredibly advanced culture, you get ridiculed or laughed at or dismissed, because that is so deeply held, even though people have never thought through at any kind of justification for it. It's a fundamental cultural story that is shared in mainstream culture.
It's perhaps the pride that comes before the fall, isn't it?
it may well be, unless, of course, we can shift those cultural stories and start to think, well, actually, you know, what is important to us? You know, how do we define a successful culture? How do we define a successful life? Is it, I mean, one of my friends said to me something very depressing once, that he was working in a very highly paid job which he despised, and I asked him why he was doing it. You know, what did he do with the money that made it worth it to spend all his time doing this thing he despised? And he said, well, it's the only way I can keep score on my life. You know, if I'm earning a lot, then I'm a success, and that's the only measure I've got, so that's what I do. And I found that such a sad answer, because you know,
what did you do? Give him a permaculture book.
Well, I maintained my friendship with him, and we talked often. But
what about friends? Don't they mean?
I was like, fine, trade me in. But I think we do have a sort of lack of. I mean, a lot of cultures. I mean, there are problems with all sorts of cultural stories, but, you know, a lot of cultures have a very defined sense of, you know, what's important and you know what's critical to their way of life. And in many ways, because we've become so individualized and atomistic and lost this sense of society, I think, I mean, in many ways, money has become a substitute for community. You know, no longer, if you want to, you know, get the tools you need, do you have to have a good relationship with your blacksmith or whoever it is, you know, or at least your local shopkeeper, because now you can just pay the money and you don't have to have any kind of relationship with them at all, and they'll give you the services. And
well, you'll get a cheap bit of forged metal from China, won't you? B&Q.
Well, yes, indeed.
In that rather stretched sense of global community.
Yeah, exactly.
We couldn't wish for a better soundtrack here, could we? We could call this the sort of post-Peak Oil sonic backdrop, couldn't we? We've got quite a few loud cars, and now we've got a helicopter buzzing over,
drowning out the happy sounds of nature.
That's right, yeah. The birds are keeping up their end of things, aren't they? The third group, and thank you. That's the
doomers.
The doomers, the people in despair. I see that in sort of biblical terms as the, it's like the 40 days and nights, isn't it? And if you can just make it through the despair and not go back to the denial, you plop out onto the other side, which is the third group for me, which is the people who are rolling their sleeves up and saying, "Yeah, come on." They might be transitioners, you know. They're likely to be people who've got a very similar mental wavelength to the people involved in the transition movement. Uh-huh. Let's do something about this.
Right.
Like, I watched the video this morning, the perma blitz, you know, people getting together, doing a garden makeover and turning it into a permaculture plot.
Right.
Fantastic. That group, I haven't got a name for them. I know about the denial and the despair people, but the shirt sleeves rolled up. What's your message of encouragement?
Maybe if you're keeping your D theme, maybe it's denials, doomers and doers.
The doers, okay, well, that's fine. Thank you for that, yeah. So what's your message to the doers?
Wow, keep it up. well, I suppose actually...
Save me a few vegetables.
Yeah, right. I think actually, I mean, the transition timeline is written for those people, really.
Right.
And because I think one thing that certainly I felt, and I think a lot of people in that category share, is a sense of, okay, we're doing what we can, but is it really enough? You know, is the scale of our response actually adequate to the scale of the challenge? Is it? Are we just doing our little bit and it's being completely overwhelmed by the scale of, you know, what's happening? And so in the transition timeline, I've tried to address that. So starting by, you know, looking at the latest science on climate change and peak oil and trying to get a really good picture of where we're actually at. But also by using this vehicle of the four scenarios, it's allowed me to, on the one hand, look at the sort of doomer outlook and say, well, look, you know, if we don't employ our ingenuity and if we don't, you know, change our ways, then yeah, it really does look awful. You know, they're not wrong. It really does. And so we kind of lay that out. But at the same time, the real focus is on the transition vision and saying, okay, if we do actually collectively, you know, shift to that, you know, get more people into that third category maybe, and, you know, collectively start doing something about it, what's the best we can realistically hope for? Because we can't pretend that we're going to suddenly, you know, roll back and in 5 years' time, you know, all the species that are going extinct will miraculously come back to life and, I don't know, we suddenly won't have an oil depletion problem or whatever else, or that, you know, all the carbon in the atmosphere is suddenly going to disappear. So there are still going to be challenges, and the transition vision scenario is not, hey, everything's fantastic, you know, it's, you know, we've got these problems, but we're actually recognising the mistakes that we made in the past and addressing them. And so I'd like to think for those doers that...
It's not so far off doomer, is it?
Well,
you just drop the M and you become a doer.
Yeah,
but maybe you're stretching the wordplay a little too far.
Maybe so. but yeah, I'd like to think that the transition timeline provides a sense of realism. It provides the... Because I think doers, when doomers talk to doers, the doomers say, that's all very well, mate. You know, it's all very nice, all this happy-clappy, we're all going to be happy in our little communities. But actually, it's just not realistic, is it? Things are far worse than that. And so the transition timeline is like the doer's answer to the doomers. It's saying, here we are, here's the thing. It's really, really thoroughly looked at all the evidence that's out there, and it's laid out a realistic, challenging, but realistic pathway to a thriving, successful, happy future.
And as well, if we doers keep doing... Mm-hmm. We create a different cultural story for the children growing into that, don't we?
Absolutely.
They know a different world.
I came across a phrase just the other week. We cannot not change the world.
Mm.
Whatever we do changes the world. If we go with the status quo and we pursue that, then we become the, you know, the unchangeable mass of people who you can't possibly convert in any way. Whereas if we just do what we can... I mean, the quote that kind of guides my life ever since I heard it is... don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do that, because what the world needs is people who've come alive.
Mm.
And I find that if you you don't need to have a guarantee of success to start doing something. So you know, you find the thing that really inspires you, that actually in your heart and your soul and your body and every part of you, you just feel like, yeah, this is what I want to do. I really believe in this.
Yeah.
And you pursue it, and you don't know where it's leading, and you don't know that you don't have a guarantee that it's going to save the world or whatever else. But
you
as
can
long
go
as
to
you,
bed pretty pleased at the end of the day,
well, yeah,
can't
you? And I mean, you know, sustainability is, in terms of people, it's a relative term. We're all going to die, you
yes,
know.
Absolutely.
And the important thing is that we spend as much of our time as possible doing things that inspire us and make us feel like we're doing something worthwhile with our lives.
Fantastic. Could you just remind us again, if people want to stay in touch with your writing, what's the best place to do that?
Yeah, my website is darkoptimism.org, and I've got a blog on there, and it also documents the various projects I'm doing, like the transition timeline. I'm the development director for Tradable Energy Quotas, which is the model of basically carbon rationing, which the government are currently examining and debating whether to introduce. And also on my website, you'll find quite a thorough links page looking at peak oil and climate change and economics and all the various areas that are sort of intertwined here. So darkoptimism.org is the place to keep up with me.
Fantastic. Thank you very much.